I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and I remember that the Provisional IRA was absolutely pilloried in the South. The people said these are criminals, murderers, fanatics, they're nothing like the good old IRA. Were the provosts and the various other groups, Republican groups, were they really much more ruthless than what had gone before? Or is that kind of a retrospective fiction?
Well, I think there's a political reason for the desire to look at them as completely different. And that was obviously that after a very early stage, it became quite clear in the South, firstly at political level and then more popularly, that they didn't want the Troubles to spill over into the South, and they didn't want any sense in which people could feel that this was unfinished business and that there was a legitimacy to what the IRA were doing. I mean, what I'm researching now and what I'm going to be hopefully writing about in the longer run is about the impact of the Northern conflict in the South. And you do see from mid-1972 on a perceptible drop in both interest and in sympathy with what's happening in the North. You can see it quite quickly after the high point, really, after Bloody Sunday. And from a very early stage, political figures in both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are saying that there is a difference, that this isn't the same. Jack Lynch, I think, says in 1972, we, Fianna Fáil, come from the true IRA, the old IRA, which has nothing to do with the IRA of today. And, of course, if you look at your Republican history and you look at your linkages, you can argue, right, but there's a thread right the way through, even in terms of personnel. There's still people involved in the IRA in the early 70s who'd been involved in the War of Independence. I mean, there's people who support the provosts who'd been in the old IRA, you know. And one of them, Dan Keating from Kerry, who at the end of his life supported the continuity IRA. I mean, he actually had been involved in the Dan War, you know, and he'd gone right the way through. So then you have to say, well, okay, there might be one or two individuals, but it's the tactics they use. The old IRA wouldn't have done that. And again, there are people who are involved in the old IRA who argued in the 70s, we would have done it if we had the capability to do it. But others were genuinely shocked and genuinely appalled. And where I think there is a big difference, and what shocked a lot of people, was obviously the use of car bombs and bombings, which by their nature kill a lot more people, I think, or cause a lot more damage. Mm-hmm. Now, the IRA in 1921 were using landmines and were using culvert bombs, and in fact, one of their biggest successes in Cork was a culvert mine attack on a regimental band, you know, of, I think, mostly unarmed soldiers. So that certainly happened. But in terms of the commercial bombing campaign, the economic bombing campaign, you'd have aspects of that before. In the 39 to 40 campaign in Britain, they'd planted bombs in cities. Nothing on the level that comes after 71, 72. And also, of course, what makes it much more complicated and what really upsets a lot of people is that quite clearly in Northern Ireland, you have a state where, whether people like it or not, a million people identify with that state, and who, for historic reasons and also because of discrimination, tended to firstly own at the time in 1972 a lot of the businesses in town centres that are being blown up or socialising them, and also be a large part of the security forces. So there is a very quickly a sectarian dimension, which you might argue existed in the Tan War, but at a much more localised level, mm-hmm. and in very contradictory ways, except in Belfast. Whereas from 1970 on, it's quite clear that a lot of the people the IRA are going to be fighting are Protestants. They're Irish Protestants, and the South, you know, people tried to get to grips with this idea over a 30-year period, and, you know, probably still haven't got to grips with it, really. But again, people might have known in the back of their minds that the RIC in 1920 were Irish, but it's sufficiently back in the past to be put away safely. When they hear about part-time UDR man shot while doing his milk round, and the politician says this is a fellow Irishman being murdered by these gangsters who don't have popular support, we can come back to that. It partly explains why people were able to very quickly adopt the idea that, well, the old IRA wouldn't have done that. And again, that's something I would have heard right from as long back as I can remember. Yeah. Even in my own family, it would have been constantly reiterated that the IRA that your relatives were in is nothing like this IRA now.
Mm-hmm. And the other difference, I think, about between the Troubles and the earlier period was that the Troubles went on for an awful lot longer.
They went on for an awful lot longer, and I suppose what might be strange about them in a minute, I know Dathi O'Corran and Eunan O'Halpin have been doing a lot of work on this project on the dead of the Irish Revolution, trying to find out for the first time how many people actually got killed between 1916 and 1921. And I think it's over 2,000, which is a lot of people in a fairly short space of time. 3,500 are killed in the north over 30 years. So in some ways, certainly the War of Independence seems to have been very intense, more intense than the Northern Troubles, you know, in terms of the amount of people killed. But it does go on for a very long time, and it does become this kind of running sore that most people in the south just want rid of. People in Britain don't know anything about really at all, except when it impacts on Britain itself. And in the north then you have two communities, particularly in working class areas, suffering the impact of this on a daily basis. They feel that they've been abandoned by both the south and Britain. For long periods, the IRA be arguably operating without a great deal of popular support, but confident enough that it can continue on and that it can achieve some kind of success. I mean, I think in the early 70s, obviously, we can come back to that, but they do think they could achieve a military and political victory. Mm-hmm. But outside of the north, most people, aside from a fairly small percentage in the south, being utterly appalled by it and just always wondering when the hell is it going to end and why. Mm-hmm. The crassest kind of view, basically, why can't these two sets of lunatics just get along? And that, unfortunately, that is the level at which a lot of people would have approached it. We can have arguments about why people in the south, many of whom who would have identified with Michael Collins or to a lesser extent with Liam Lynch and others at the same time were utterly alienated from any idea of being interested in the north at all by the 1990s.
One of the reasons it went on for so long is because a new leadership came into the IRA, the provisional IRA, at the end of the 1970s, the Adams-Bell, mm-hmm. I think, leadership. McGuinness came a little bit later, I think. They were determined to have this thing called the Long War, where they would continue the campaign forever, more or less. Whereas the older, the southern leadership under people like Rory O'Brody, I think wanted to bring it to an end in the later 70s.
Well, certainly the impression you get is that it's a bit earlier than that, I suppose, that if you look at what Di O'Connell and Rory O'Brody are saying in 1974-75, even their reaction to the Ulster Workers' Council stoppage that brought down Sunningdale, they do have some kind of realisation that they need to have something to say to the Northern Unionists. And also that the sheer level of violence and the sheer level of war weariness is really intense, particularly in the areas of Belfast that are under massive sectarian pressure from loyalists in the mid-70s. And they do, I think, you may never know the truth of it, but I think certainly the impression that's given by people who are in contact with them and in negotiations with them is that people like O'Brody and O'Connell were prepared to bring it to an end, or at least believed that some kind of settlement was in prospect. Now, their view, and again it seems to have been widely believed, was that the British told them they were going. And I think the British, and people laugh at the idea now, but I think it did cross the British government's mind that there were possibilities to just withdraw. And certainly that did keep the provost going for longer, because they believed, well, we nearly got them to leave, so if we keep this up, they will eventually leave. But things are in a mess in some ways. You have widespread sectarian killings, 75, 76, which the provisional IRA are involved in as well. You have a desire, I think, among some to try and bring it to an end. And then in reaction to that, you have a younger leadership who've emerged really during the conflict itself. Although people like Gerry Adams and Ivor Bell had been members of the IRA before 1969, but you have other people then like Martin McGuinness, who joined it post-69, who have been in prison. A lot of them have seen their comrades killed and injured, have experienced British tactics at close hand, and who I think thought, well, if the older people haven't got the stomach for this, we have, and we can continue it on. And okay, we mightn't be able to continue it at the level that you saw in the early 70s, but we have a different idea, and we can both continue an armed campaign, and eventually the idea emerges of seeking political support as well and popular support, and that's influenced by a whole range of ideas. If you look at the propaganda of the IRA in the late 70s, early 80s, it's in no way apologetic about the fact that violence has to be used and that they're killing, whether it's of a part-time UDR man or of the governor of Lancash or the deputy governor, is celebrated as part of blows that will bring home to the British eventually the need to leave Ireland. I think they absolutely do believe it. The theory that the peace process evolves in 1975, I just don't buy. I think they do think mm-hmm. that you can have a war and you can build up popular support in the north.
1980s and 1990s is this kind of callousness that they had a choice to stop it and they didn't.
They would have argued that they didn't have a choice. The IRA's historic argument is that they were responding to a war that had been brought to them and that there was a demand from nationalists that they defend them, not just against loyalists but against the British state, and that it just wasn't as simple as stopping. I mean, the argument that they would advance is that they by eventually deciding themselves when they'd have their, if you accept that they did decide themselves when they went to call a ceasefire, that they had achieved certain things. Mm-hmm. Now, they weren't the things that they told their own supporters they were going to achieve. Mm-hmm. The influence of spies and informers and the influence of the loyalist campaign in the early 1990s, which, you know, some Republicans will admit did them a huge amount of damage in terms of terror it inflicted on a lot of communities, and also the extent to which the British and what people, you know, I think a lot of people in academia, which hasn't really, you know, Southern Irish academia hasn't really grappled with this to any extent, and it will come out probably in the long run, the extent to which British intelligence services were involved in a dirty war in the north, and nobody has clean hands in terms of civilian deaths or allowing people to be killed to protect other people. So I think that explains in some ways the decisions that Republican leaderships take, more than simply the narrative of betrayal, although obviously those on the receiving end are always going to feel betrayed.